But the genealogies are important, so we're not going to skip over them. But before we get into the genealogies, we kind of go back to where we were at last time in Genesis 35. If you remember, Jacob had been told to go back up to Bethel and to worship God at Bethel. And you remember what he had to do in order to worship God in a correct way? What was the first thing that he had to do, or the most important thing that he had to do? Do y'all remember it? He had to bury his idols, didn't he? He had to bury all those things that came between him and God so that he could really, truly experience God. And so we see him at Bethel worshiping God, and then God prepares him for some tragedies in his life through this worship. I mean, he has the death of Rachel, and then he has the death of Deborah, Rebekah's nurse. And then he has the death of Isaac, and it was this encounter with God that kind of prepared him for all of those great tragedies in his life. Well, now he's moving up to Hebron, and he's going to dwell there now. And we're going to see him kind of go back and forth between being Jacob and being flounder between being Jacob and being Israel, as we finish up the book of Genesis. But before we get back to the story of Jacob, let's pick up in the genealogy that we get in chapter 36, and that is the genealogy of Esau. Now, really, we're not going to spend much time in this, just look at a couple of things, but reading verse number 1 of chapter 36, it says, "Now this is the genealogy of Esau, who is Edom." Now, that word genealogy, again, is, you ought to know it by now. What's that Hebrew word? It's toledot. We talked about that Sunday, and we've seen that word over and over again. Whenever we see that word toledot, what is it telling us? Do you remember? It's telling us that we're about to embark on a new theme, and we're at a crossroads. One of the genealogies is passing, and which genealogy is going to continue? The genealogy that leads us to David and on to the Messiah, Jesus Christ. And so God has a purpose in all of this, and between every genealogy, there's a new theme that we're coming upon, so we kind of look for what the new theme is going to be. You got any idea, those of you that have studied Genesis, where we're heading? What's going to happen next? Who knows? What's the new theme that we're going into? All you scholars. Do we have any scholars here? Huh? Well, he's in the land of Canaan. He's in Hebron now. So what? Really, actually, something else is being set up. What do you think? Huh? Well, they're becoming a nation, and they were kind of doing that before, but there is, that's part of the main theme. What's being set up here? Who's the main character going to be now as we head into the next part of the Genesis? Joseph, okay? Most would say Joseph, but there's another main character. Who can tell me who the other main character is in the rest of the book of, and we'll leave Jacob is there too, but outside of Jacob and Joseph. Who's the main character?
Not Judah.
Huh? Moses? Moses in Genesis? No. We're talking about the rest of Genesis. That was kind of a trick question, but we're going to see Moses. And what's happening here is kind of setting up the stage for Moses to come on the scene. So I'm pestering you all a little bit, but I'll tell you who the other main character, and a lot of people miss this, is Judah. Judah, in fact, the next chapter after we finish 37 tonight is all about Judah. Now, why is Judah so important? Who can tell me why Judah is so important? That's the tribe of Jesus Christ. That's the tribe the Messiah comes from. That's the tribe David comes from. And so that's really the main point. And so a lot of people focus all their attention on Joseph, and they miss the fact that God is really telling us what's happening to Judah. And so Judah is one of the main characters. And then he's also telling us what somebody mentioned, the nation of Israel. He's telling us what's happening to the nation of Israel and what's going to happen in these last few chapters. What's being set up for the nation of Israel? Where are they going to end up before this is all over? In Egypt. See, that's what you're seeing. You're seeing the sovereign plan of God to get the nation of Israel into this stage where they're in the womb of Egypt, where they're nurtured and eventually into slavery so that they can be delivered into the promised land. So it's almost like a birth. They're almost going into a gestation period as they head into the nation of Egypt. And so God is setting all of that up, and he's going to set that up through two characters. He's going to set it up through, or actually three, Judah, Jacob, and Joseph. and Judah being the line that David's going to come through and the Messiah's going to come through, but Jacob's going to be important in the story, and so is Joseph, because it's going to be Joseph that's going to save the nation and bring the nation into Egypt. Now that's a good thing, and that's a bad thing. It starts out a good thing and ends up a bad thing, but it is the sovereign plan of God to have that nation born out of Egypt. Okay? So that's really what we're setting up here. Now, the genealogy of Esau, we're going to leave O Esau, but it says in verse number 36 that Esau is Edom. Now, who is Edom? We know about Edom. Edom's, we'll see several times in the Bible, who are the Edomites? From Edom come the Edomites. Do you remember the Edomites? They're the ones later on when Moses in the Exodus is leaving and he wants to pass through the land of Edom, and they won't allow him through, and then Moses wants to kill him, and God says, no, you can't kill him because they're your brother. You know, Edom is your brother. And then later on, we'll see when we get into the Kings, or actually in the 2 Samuel, we'll see David conquer the Edomites. And then later on in prophecy and stuff, you'll see the Edomites join with the ranks of their enemies, and they'll get set free, and they'll be against Israel. And then later on, when you get into the New Testament, the Edomites are the Idumeans, who are the nation of Herod. And so actually Herod is a Edomite. And so all the reign of Herod, that empire comes from Edom. And so they rule over Israel, or really under the headship of Rome, they rule over Israel. And then in prophecy, in the end times, there's this picture of Edom coming up against Israel. And most scholars believe that's, the land of Jordan. So you'll see them throughout the Bible and throughout history. So anyway, Esau is the father of the Edomites. All right, now, and look at verse, verse 12. Go to verse 12, and here's another group that comes out of the line of Esau. It says in verse 12, now Timna was the concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bore Amalek. You remember the guy Amalek? Who's Amalek? He becomes the father of who? The Amalekites, and they are an arch enemy of Israel. And so we'll see the Amalekites as we go through. And really, that's about the only ones that come through the genealogy, and it kind of finishes up with that last phrase in verse 43 where it says Esau was the father of the Edomites. Now, one of the things, and you can go back and you can read this genealogy, but one of the things that you see here, you see a partial fulfillment here of the Abrahamic covenant, because what was one of the things that God told Abraham? That through your seed will come many nations, many kings and many nations. And Esau is what? He's the grandson of Abraham. Now, if I get one of these names mixed up, y'all raise your hand and correct me, but he's the grandson of Abraham. And so he has through him, and you can just look, there's the list of these kings and chiefs. And so you're starting to see the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant, that part of it where there's many kings and many nations. All right, now, I think that's really all we want to get out of that genealogy. And with that said, we can pick up in chapter number 37. All right. Now, there's a really profound verse here as we start off. We've got to spend a little bit of time on it. The very first verse. It said, now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. Now, that word dwelt in the Hebrew, it has two meanings. To settle, or it can be used to marry. You see marry in M-A-R-R-Y elsewhere in the English version of the Old Testament. It's that same word that's given here as dwelt. Now, so you could translate it this way. Now, Jacob was married to the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. And so you see a problem maybe here with Jacob. What has Jacob done again now? Remember, he was told that, to head to Bethel. He went to Succoth, and then he went over to Shechem. Now he's up in Hebron, and he's in the promised land, but he's doing something that Abraham didn't do and that Isaac didn't do. And what's he doing? He's married to the land. And is that what he was called to do? He was called to be what in that land? A sojourner and a pilgrim in that land. because he's really a child of God. And what's his home city? His home city, if you go over to the book of Hebrews, his home city of Abraham is for Jacob is the same home city. And what home city is that? That's the heavenly Jerusalem. And so he set his heart. He's actually married to the land. He's settled in the land. And you know, I think there's an application there for us. Remember in our study in 2 Peter where Peter said, "Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lust." And so, and he addresses in the letters to Peter, how does he address the church? As sojourners and pilgrims. And so what should we be? We should be pilgrims in this land. And there's a real danger sometimes that we tend to settle in the land where God has placed us and we become married to the land. Now, you know, we've been really blessed in the United States of America, and you know, I mean, I could go back 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and me, it'd be real easy to kind of be married to the land and settled in the land. You know, you think of it as a godly land, as a godly place, and I think maybe the good thing that's coming out of all the political scene right now is that it's maybe some of the nationalism that we're so prone to is maybe kind of being stripped away from us. Maybe some of us are too married to the United States of America, and we see this as our final homeland instead of seeing ourselves as pilgrims. And so you start seeing the things that are going on with this country, and you realize that maybe this really isn't a Christian country. Maybe I'm not married to this land, and I'm certainly not saying that we shouldn't be involved in politics. We shouldn't be praying for our country. We just did. But we shouldn't be married to any land, any nation that we're part of, because we are children of Jesus Christ, and our home is the heavenly Jerusalem, Mount Zion, and that should be our home. So there's a lesson here for us too. All right, now, in verse number 2, it says, "This is the history of Jacob." Now, that word history is the same word toledot. So we're coming up on, you know, we had this theme of the genealogy of Esau, and now again we're coming up on a new theme, and so it says this is the toledot, the genealogy of Jacob. And it's that's why that word can't just be translated genealogy, because he's not about to give us a genealogy, but we're starting to get a new theme. So he says this is the toledot of Jacob, Joseph being 17 years old, and here's the new character in the genealogy. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding his flock with his brothers. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wife. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now, what does that mean, a bad report? What was he doing there? Tattletale. He was tattling on them. These were bad boys. Those 11 sons were bad boys. Are those 10 sons, Benjamin and Joseph, I think were different. And I think we're going to see why here in just a minute. But they were doing bad things all the time. I mean, they're going to do bad things to Joseph here in just a minute. But they were bad, bad boys. And so Joseph, man, he comes back. He says, "Dad," he becomes of age, and his dad sends him out and gives him this coat of many colors we'll see in just a minute. And he kind of gives him a little bit of authority. And he goes out and he sees what his brothers are doing. He comes back and he says, "Man, Dad, these guys are terrible." So look at verse number 3. It says, "Now Israel," now we get a, look at what happens here. We get a change in names. From Jacob, deceiver and hill catcher, to Israel. Israel loved Joseph. Now, there's a point being made right there. I have no doubt about it. What's Israel mean? Prince with God, or warrior with God. In other words, he's walking with God. Now, why is that in the context of Joseph? He loved Joseph. Because I think Jacob at this point realizes that he's made lots of mistakes in raising his first 10 sons. And so he takes his next two sons, Joseph and Benjamin, and I believe he raises them in the things of the Lord. He makes the things of Jehovah very important. He makes those issues very important to those sons. And one of the reasons I know that is later on, when Joseph is taken to Egypt, what kind of character does he exhibit? He doesn't exhibit the character of his 12 brothers, does he? I mean, his 10 brothers, he doesn't exhibit that. He exhibits a godly character. He calls upon the Lord constantly. And when Potiphar's wife chases him down, he says, hey, man, I would never do this to the Lord Jehovah. And when he's in jail, he has these dreams and these visions, and he gives all the credit to who? To Jehovah God. And so somewhere he's gotten some upbringing that the other sons didn't get, and I believe that came from Israel. The most important thing we can do as parents is to be Israel's, to walk with God and let our children see us walking with God and to talk about the things of God and talk and bring involve God in our decisions. Now, Jacob's still going to act like Jacob, but he's also going to teach these boys and bring them up right, I believe. So anyway, it says in verse 3, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was a son of his old age, and he had changed some in his old age. And so he makes him this tunic of many colors. All right, now, that tunic of many colors, and, you know, a lot of expositors will say, well, in that culture that was, you know, made him, gave him authority, that made him, gave him the birthright. I don't think he gave him the birthright at this point, because later on when he prophesies, he doesn't give Joseph the birthright. He'll actually give that birthright to Judah. And he'll explain why he gave it to Judah over the older sons, because of what the things that they had done. And so I don't think that that's what he's doing here. I think, you know, more than likely he just made him a coat because he was special to him. And the brothers realized that, hey, he's special. He's more special he's Jacob's favorite. Joseph is Jacob's favorite son. And so what do you think the brothers' reaction is going to be? They're not going to like that at all. But look at verse number 4. So when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, what did they see in that coat? And probably all the other things Jacob did for Joseph, they saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers. Now, is that good parenting? No. No, that's terrible parenting. I mean, you might have a child that you in some ways you admire more or less or whatever. I don't think you should even do that. But let's say you do, and then just by one out achieves the other, and out has sweeter character, or whatever, and somehow you're more attracted to that child. You still, as a parent, we can't treat one child better than the other, and you're going to cause problems two ways if we do that. You're going to cause problem for that child, and you're going to cause problem because the other child or children are not going to like that child. And that child's going to become a brat. And I really believe that's what happened with Joseph. I believe he had become a brat. All right. So when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all the brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably. They couldn't talk to him without getting in a fight. It says, now Joseph just tacks it on, though. Look what happens next. Joseph had a dream, and no doubt that dream comes from God. That he told his brothers, and they hated it even more. So he said to them, please hear this dream. I had a dream, and I want you to hear my dream. Joseph, you should have shut up. But they were binding sheaves in the field, and then behold, my sheaf arose also, stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. And there's probably some prophecy in there about the famine where Joseph's going to provide for them. They're not going to be able to provide for themselves. But in any case, it's obvious anybody hearing that dream would know exactly what he was saying. One day you guys are going to be subservient to me. And they already hated him, so how do you think they feel about him now? They really, really hate him now. But that's not all. And his brother said to him, shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. But he dreamed another dream and told his brothers and said, look, I have dreamed another dream. And this time the sun, the moon, this is what we saw over in Revelation chapter 12. And I'm not going to go there tonight, but that's interesting that this is tacked to the nation of Israel. And that's why, you know, when you get over to Revelation 12, that it's speaking of the nation of Israel. Okay? Because it's quoting back from this dream. It says, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. So he told his father and his brothers, and Jacob knew exactly what the dream was saying. And so Jacob said to him, hey, what is this dream that you've dreamed? Shall your mother and me and your brothers indeed come to you, bow down to the earth before you? I think probably for Jacob it was all right for the brothers to bow down, but he wasn't, what are you saying? I'm going to bow down to you too? And look at what Jacob does here. He makes another mistake. He says, and his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. In other words, he kept it to himself. He didn't do anything about it. What should Jacob have done at this point? He should have set Joseph down. He should have said, Joseph, I mean, maybe this dream did come from God, but you need to keep that dream to yourself. You don't need to be sharing that dream, because in sharing that dream, you're doing nothing but intimidating your brothers. And he probably should have set them all down. They all should have had a conversation about it and done something to kind of repair the breach. But he just kept it to himself and didn't do anything about it. I have no doubt that those dreams came from God, because those dreams will be fulfilled in prophecy. I mean, those prophetic dreams will come true. We'll see later on as we finish up in Genesis. But it came from God. But there's a lesson there. Friends, sometimes God gives you a vision, or he gives you a dream, and it's not, or gives you some type of miracle. It don't be sharing that miracle or that dream unless God tells you to. Because there's a real danger lurking whenever God does something special in our lives, is to think somehow that we're special. So, and maybe we are. I mean, we are all special. But somehow that we're more special than somebody else. And pride's a real tricky thing, isn't it? And so pride, you say, hey, I had a miracle and you didn't. You know, and I'll tell you what, God'll not, and I think there's time where God will tell you to share that miracle. There'll be a point where you need to share that miracle. But a lot of times I think it's for us to keep to ourselves. And I think we have to be real careful with it. If you can share the miracle and know you're not doing it privately, then it's okay. Kim was coming back from his eye surgery, and I went over to his house to visit him, and I shared with him, man, I don't see how you handle all that pain and all of everything that's going on with you. I said, you know, when you guys prayed for me 3 years, it was like 3 years, 2 or 3 years ago, I said, for my kidney infection, I said, God healed me, and I haven't even had a cold since then. Well, the next day began the worst cold I've had in about 5 years. And I could just hear God saying, you hadn't had a cold? Okay, well, I'll give you one. I really think we really have to watch and be very careful. I mean, God is working in our lives all the time, doing great things in our life, but when we go to share any type of miracle that God's done for us, we need to be sure that we're not doing it pridefully, that we're doing it for maybe to help somebody, to encourage somebody. That's one thing. But to do it because look what God's done for me, then that's wrong. I mean, the Bible does teach that God is not a respecter of persons. But the Bible also teaches that God loved Jacob and Esau he hated. I mean, he's not a respecter of persons. God will do anything for you that he did for David. If you have a heart for him like David had for him, that he'll do the same things, you know, or different things, maybe different, but he'll do some of the great things he did for David, he'll do in your life, and I believe that. But God will also, if we get a little puffed up, he's going to humble us, isn't he? And here's Jacob. I believe no doubt at this point he's puffed up. His dad loves him more than he loves his children. And, I mean, he's had 17 years of this, being pampered and spoiled, but raised in the Lord, I believe, raised to love Jehovah. But he's still being spoiled. He's a tattletale. And by tattling, what's he doing? He's saying, look, he's being self-righteous. Somehow, look at what, you know, I'm a moral person. These kids are not moral. He's looking down on his brother, so he's being kind of self-righteous. And he's being a braggart. He's bragging about the dream that God has given him. And I think there's a real danger in that. And I think especially for us parents that raise our children up as Christians, to be real careful that we don't raise them to where they're judging other people. I mean, there's a real danger in that. I mean, that somehow they don't see the grace of God. Somehow they think they deserve the status that they have in Christ. No, the same grace that saves the worst sinner saves all of us. And so we have to be real careful with that. And so Jacob wasn't. And he's got a bad kid on his hands and a good kid who's acting bad and he's full of pride. And what's God going to have to do? God's going to, before he can use him in a mighty way. You want to know why Joseph was sent off to Egypt and into slavery? He was being prepared for the great task that Jacob hadn't prepared him for. Jacob had prepared him, had made him a pompous young man who would be the worst kind of leader, and along with the good things he did. But God's gonna fix all of that through a few decades in a jail. So in slavery and in a jail. So he'll come out of it. All right, now, verses 12 through 14. It says, "Then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, 'Are your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them.' So he said to him, 'Here I am.' Then he said, 'Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me.' So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem." Now, that's a long ways off. It's about 60 miles away. Now, why would they maybe be over in Shechem? Well, sheep herders would travel miles and miles and miles to find pasture. But if you remember, Jacob also owned some land in Shechem, probably still had flocks in Shechem. So that would be one reason they would be there. So anyway, they're like 60 miles away, and he goes out and he looks for his brothers and he can't find them. But he said, "Now a certain man found him, and there he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, 'What are you seeking?' So he said, 'I'm seeking my brothers,' and they would be easy to find because they had these large flocks of sheep. He says, 'Please tell me they are feeding their flocks.' And the man said, 'They have departed from here, and they not only have they gone 60 miles north to Shechem, now they've gone another 30 miles north to Dothan.' So he said, 'I heard them say, let us go to Dothan.' So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan." All right, now, in verse number 18, it says, "Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him." Now this wasn't some hot-tempered, spur-of-the-moment thing. They saw him coming and they thought, "Hey, we got an opportunity. We got him off by himself. Let's think of a way we can kill him." And then they said to one another, "Look, the dreamer is coming. The one who dreamed that he's going to rule over us, he's coming." He said in verse 20, "Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams." When Reuben heard of their plans, and he delivered him out of their hands, and he said, "Let us don't kill him." Now, Reuben is what? Reuben's the oldest son. And so who's going to be responsible for this if word gets back to Jacob that his brother's been killed? Reuben's going to be responsible. I don't think Reuben cared for Joseph either, but he knew that if this, sooner or later, if this was found out, that he would be the one that would take the fall. And so he didn't want it to happen. So in verse 22 it says, "And Reuben said to them, 'Shed no blood, but hey, let's cast him into the pit which is in the wilderness and don't lay a hand on him, and then we'll decide what we'll do.'" And then what he was thinking in the back of his mind, that he would deliver them. And I mean, he knew they were set on doing something terrible to Joseph. And so he gave them another plan that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. And so it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him, and they took him and they cast him in the pit, and the pit was empty and there was no water in it. And they, and now look at how terrible these guys are. Look at, I mean, here's their brother, stripped down, thrown into a pit. What do? They don't bother them a bit. They sat down to eat a meal. And then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites and Midianites that were a company traveling together. Some people have a problem with this because one verse it mentions the Ishmaelites and one verse it mentions the Midianites, but it wouldn't be uncommon for them to be trading together. And so it says, "A company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, 'What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites.'" So they devise a plan where they make some money out of the deal and still get rid of him because they figure if he goes into slavery, they'll never see him again. And so they said, "Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh, and his brothers listen." Then the Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Jacob up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Then Reuben returns to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and so he tore his clothes, and he returned to his brothers and said, "The lad is no more. How can I, Where shall I go? I can't even go home. There's no way I can face Jacob without Joseph. And look what you guys have done. So they devised, took the plan a little bit further. How are they going to fool Jacob? So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. And then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, "We have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not?" And he recognized it and said, "It is Joseph's tunic." And they figured a wild beast has devoured him, and without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters, after those many days, came arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. He said, "I'm never going to be comforted, for I shall go down to the grave to my son in mourning." Thus his father wept for him and continued to weep for him and mourn for him. And then you get the conclusion, and it sets us up for the next week. And now it says the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. All right, one little issue I want to address here before we leave, finish this up tonight. If you were to read commentaries, almost any commentary on what happens to Joseph, they're going to make an issue of what happens in verse number 31 where it says, they killed a kid of the goats and dipped the tunic in the blood. In other words, they used a goat to fool Jacob. Does that sound familiar? What's it sound like? What's it remind you of? What did Jacob use to fool Isaac? A goat. Okay, and so most expositors will come to this verse right here, and they will tell you that this is payback for Jacob. In other words, what you sow is what you reap. And so, you know, it's as if God was just waiting for this opportunity or this opportune time to pay back Joseph for the dastardly deed that he did to Esau. Now, do you agree with that? Well, if you do, you better look out, because you've done some dastardly deeds in your life too, and God might just be sitting there waiting to pay you back. And that's kind of the implication you get from that interpretation of the text. I don't agree with that at all. I don't believe that God saved this incident to pay Jacob back for deceiving his brother Esau. And in other words, we have a God, and all I've seen coming up to this point is if God had wanted to destroy Jacob, he's had ample opportunity to destroy him. He didn't have to wait here to take away Joseph. I don't think that's his purpose in this at all. Now, with that said, God, in his providence, did know this was going to happen, and he let it happen. And it is true that even as a Christian, even as a child of God, that if you continue sowing in a certain way, then you are going to reap problems. I don't think it was the one incident with Esau that was the problem. I mean, that could have been overcome a long time ago. But what's the pattern with Jacob? That pattern has continued on and on and on and on and on, hasn't it? And so Jacob's got some problems that he is reaping what he sowed. I mean, he's still been a deceiver. He's still been a wheeler dealer, and at least up until the time he wrestled with God. And what happened to his older sons? They learned from all of that. They learned to lie and to deceive. And over the years, they kept learning that. It wasn't that one incident, but he did create this situation with these children that did cause the problem ultimately with Joseph. And so that's one problem. But Jacob also had other problems that he was sowing to. He was dwelling in the land when he should have been a stranger in the land. If we as parents are continually sowing to this world, and all our efforts are into this world, and all our attention is in this world, then we can expect to reap some problems with our children. We can't one day wake up and expect them all to be godly children. That's not going to happen. And so that's true too. showing favoritism. When he was sowing favoritism to Joseph and probably Benjamin too, then he was going to reap some trouble somewhere down the line, wasn't he? And so that favoritism made Joseph's brothers hate Joseph, and so they were willing to do this dastardly deed. Probably if there had been no favoritism, if one of those, maybe Reuben had been the favorite, maybe this wouldn't have happened. If none of them had been the favorite, it would have been the best thing. But even with that said, this, what happens here, and this is what I want you to see, and this is how we see God working all things together for the good of those that love the Lord. This is really not, has very little to do with Jacob. This is part of God's sovereign plan for the nation of Israel. He's doing three things right here that I want you to see. One is he's going to save the nation of Israel by sending Joseph off to slavery. That's why God allowed it, because there's going to become a great famine on the land that God is going to, in his providence, produce or allow to happen that would have destroyed the nation if Joseph hadn't have been in Israel. The second thing that God is doing right here, he's going to work in Joseph. That little brat, that little tattletale, that prideful young man, Jacob never would have straightened him out, but God is going to use the next couple of decades to straighten him out. And let me tell you what, friends, if we don't raise our kids right, God will take over for us if they're children of God. And we might see things happen to them that, man, how can that happen to my child? But maybe God's picking up and doing some things in their life that we should have done as parents in the first place. But God has Joseph's best interest in mind. Joseph is, to me, if you want to look for a type of Jesus Christ in the Old Testament, Joseph fits the bill probably better than anything. He has a great heart. He has a forgiving heart. He's going to forgive his brothers, just like Jesus said, forgive them for they know not what they do. He forgave the Jews. I mean, he's going to forgive them. He's sold by his own brothers, but to the Gentiles, just like Jesus was sold. And he's buried in a pit, just like Jesus was buried in a pit. And there's lots of correlations between Joseph and Jesus. But the reason Joseph is a man he is, when you see him in the end, is because of those years under Potiphar as a slave and in prison, all of those years that made Joseph the man that he is. And then probably just as important as all the rest of it is this, that God is working in a nation, the nation of Israel. He has taken the nation. He had this plan before the foundation of the world. They're going to go down to Egypt and they're going to stay there. How long? Do y'all know? 400 years. Why God birthed that nation. I mean, the nation's already birthed, but it's really just an embryo right now. And he's going to put it in the womb of the mother Egypt. And maybe that's a bad analogy, but the nation Egypt. And there it really is. It's going to be nurtured. It's going to be fed. It's going to be prepared as a nation to be birthed in the promised land at some point. And so that's what God's working in all of this. And that's why no matter what's happening in the United States of America, no, what's happening in my life, I know that all of this is working for God's sovereign plan. And I can take the same comfort that Jacob didn't have any comfort at this point, but if Jacob had been the man of faith that he should have been at this point, he would have had comfort. He would have had comfort. He would have believed just like David believed when that baby died because of his sin with Bathsheba, and David quit mourning and went to eat, and they said, how can you do this? He said, because I know that that child is with God. I know that that child, even if Jacob thought Joseph was dead, he should have known that Joseph was part of that promise, and he should have faith and trust God. And so that's what God is working in all of this. And as we finish up, as we go to the next chapter, read the next chapter ahead of time. If you want to read, if you like soap operas, you got one right there in chapter 38. One of those chapters you wonder, why in the world is it even in the Bible? As we study this terrible story of Judah and Tamar. But it's part of that plan too. And we're going to see it all play out as we head into the rest of the Old Testament. All right, let's go to the Lord in prayer. Father, we just praise you and thank you for your word and just how intricately woven together it is and how perfect it is. And Lord, how we see your plans working in the lives of these great patriarchs, Lord, and people that did things worse than maybe some of us have done, Lord. But through your mercy and grace, you were forming a nation that would bring forth our Messiah, Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, who died for us on a cross and who sits at the right hand of glory right now, Lord. And he's our life and our joy and our peace. And Lord, we just thank you for all that you're doing, not only in our lives, but in the lives of all your children. And we know that all things are working together for the good of those that love you. And we love you, Father, and thank you for your goodness to us all. It's in Christ's name that I pray. Amen.